in conversation with musicians from the UK jazz scene. And now your hosts, Rob Cope and Dan Farrant.
Hello, Dan.
Hello, hello, hello.
How are you doing?
Doing well. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Welcome, everyone, to the Jazz Podcast, episode something, 100 and something. It's the 12th of July. My name is Rob Cope, and of course, it's Dan Farrant with me today. Where are you, Dan?
I'm at home, Rob.
Oh, delicious. Yeah. Have you been watching much of the old tennis Wimbledon this week?
Oh, I haven't. I watched a couple of shots, more games, not really
shots, eh?
Yeah, I guess games. Yeah, no, but sadly haven't been able to watch much of it. Have you?
Yeah, you know, I've been keeping an eye on things. Seeing as you haven't watched very much, you seem like the perfect guy. Maybe you're not emotionally entangled and compromised, and you could probably pick a winner. Do you have any strong feelings? Based on no facts whatsoever.
I don't know who's still in it. Federer.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go.
Can't go wrong.
Called it.
Yeah. I'd love for Nadal to win, but I have a feeling that Djokovic overall will.
Djokovic will be.
Oh, Claire's.
I heard that.
What about the women's? We've got Halep.
Serena.
And Serena playing.
Yeah, Serena. Yeah,
I'd like Serena to get her 24th Grand Slam. That would be cool.
Did I tell you when I met Serena?
I remember she was staying in your building, right?
Yeah.
Man, that's cool.
That was so weird.
So Dan used to live in Wimbledon. You know, and the tennis players would like rent out flats in your building. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, there was a penthouse above us. We were on the third floor and there was a penthouse above us.
So she was right above you. You could hear her footsteps.
Well, we didn't hear her footsteps, but when I got in the lift one morning, it opened up and then Serena was taking up the whole lift. I was like, oh, hi.
Great. Did she say anything? I assume she said hi to you.
She said hi.
Oh, lovely.
And then I said, good luck. I'll take the stairs.
Nice. Very classy. Don't worry, Serena. I'll get the stairs. You can stay in the lift.
Yeah.
Wow.
Good times.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well played, lads. So I had my album launch on Friday.
Oh, Rob, how did it go?
Yeah, it was good. It was really great. Lots of
the
people
gods
came.
Of Apollo smiling down on you.
They did indeed, yes. Yes. So yeah, it was cool. And now, allegedly, you can buy my album, listen to it on Spotify or something. I haven't tried any of those things, but...
Well, let's try. Rob, show.
Shall we? All right. What are you looking on, Spotify?
Yeah, oh, look at that nice logo, that nice album cover design there.
Thanks, your wife did it. That's why it's good.
Oh, when you click on it, it goes to the Jazz Podcast.
Oh, controversial.
Album preview.
Wow, cool. Okay, well, you know, that's nice, because then if the listeners try to get away from this to check that out, they'll come right back to this.
Oh, I found the album. You have to search Gods of Apollo.
Ah, delicious.
If you search Rob Cope, it...
is nothing.
There you go. Oh, look at those names.
Yeah.
Neil.
Yeah.
Watching.
Exactly.
What one should we check out if we haven't got long? Because I don't have 12 minutes. I'm not listening to Sputnik, let's be honest.
Probably
Flames.
Check out do Flames. That's not the vibe. Listen to Neil. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Okay, I'll listen to Neil.
If you don't want to listen to me, then the fifth one doesn't really... I don't really play on that. It's all Elliot Galvin.
Right. Well, you've got 38 monthly listeners, Rob.
Have I?
Yeah.
That's incredible. That's probably literally 38 people have listened to it.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's going to be 39 now.
Yeah. Business is roaring.
And after this podcast, it will still be 39.
It will be. Maybe it will go back down. So today is Mike Chillingworth, which you could tell if you're listening, because it says in the title.
Great.
Yes, a long-anticipated episode with one of London's most spectacular alto saxophone players. This guy, he's a bit like Serena. You know, he's really sweet and quiet and gentle, absolutely lovely. But then when the music starts, he's vicious and terrifying.
Right.
you know?
Good combination.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to do, you know, there's like battles. I've never been in one. Some kind of like improvisation battle where you and someone else would like face off, you know? And like,
right,
I don't know, take a chorus of the blues each or something. You know, I don't know. I don't even know if that's a thing, but if it was and you had to do it against Chillingworth, you'd be in big trouble.
Yeah.
Big, big trouble. So we're going to play a track from his, in fact, I don't remember which one we put first. Let's have a look. What is first? Oh, yeah, a clip from Morley College, which is a really nice, a fantastic new series that Flavio Lavigni's running. This is near Waterloo, jazz at Morley College, and each gig is an interview first, and then that gets put out as a podcast, and then the band come on and play some tunes. So if you want to learn something about jazz, you're probably much better off there than here.
I think they've already gathered that.
Yeah, you're right. That's true. So this track is called Friday the 13th. It's with Ivo Neem, Connor Chaplin and John Scott. And before I press play, I'm contractually obliged to tell you that Mike and his band is playing. They're playing with Tom Farmer on bass next Thursday, the 18th, at the Vortex. That's Thursday, the 18th, people. Vortex Jazz Club. If you like this clip, then you should probably go and have a little look.
It's going to be booked up, though, isn't it, now that you've mentioned it?
Yeah. Yeah, quickly pause the show and get on the website, because obviously these tickets are going, like hotcakes. I never really understood that phrase, but I think that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, undoubtedly.
All right, so here's Friday the 13th. Mike Chillingworth, welcome
Hello.
To the Jazz Podcast.
Thank you. Lovely to be on the Jazz Podcast.
Oh, man, we're thrilled to have you. And as we've just discussed, Rick Simpson is going to be thrilled that you're here.
He is. I'm absolutely sure he will be the first person to listen.
Yep. This is almost like a fan request show, except not, because literally everyone I know wants you to be on the Jazz Podcast, Mike.
I live to please.
Well, before we start, my favourite ever nickname for you when I first got to London was Killingworth. I might just go with that from this point on.
Great.
Yep. So, why don't you tell our listeners who you are, Mike, in case anyone hasn't heard of you and is really confused and doesn't know who Rick Simpson is either, and still somehow hasn't turned it off yet.
I am a saxophone player in London, and Rick Simpson is a piano player in London who, well, I don't know. You've got to get Rick. Have you had Rick Simpson on yet?
No, we actually haven't.
Oh, well, you've got to get Rick on.
I know, I mean, there's so many good ones left. It's like we haven't even started yet.
That'll be one of the best ones, I would imagine. I mean, you know, if you can cope with the craziness, that'd be great.
Yeah. We follow him on Twitter, and it's always just such a great experience.
Well, there you go. You've got to bring some of that into your podcast. Yeah. Well, anyway, yeah, I mean, I'm a sax player and, you know, jazz musician, play with lots of people. I play with Ant Law. I play in Callum Gourlay's big band. I used to be in Round Trip with Rich Turner. I have my own band. I had a septet. We made a record a few years ago. I've got a new band. It's a quartet. Yeah, I don't know. It's not much else to say, really.
Not much except that enormous back catalogue of incredible work.
Yeah, well, small back catalogue, yeah. All right. Probably lots of things. It's hard to remember, isn't it? You know, you do all these things, they kind of come out, and then you move on, and, like, yeah. I think I need to go back and, like, compile a little discography at some point.
I did that once for my website, where you could click on each link and buy the album.
Yeah, I've seen people do that.
Yeah, but then it all sort of crashed, and I got annoyed by it.
Yeah, good.
Yeah, excellent work by me there. So why don't you tell us, how did you get into even playing the saxophone? Where did it all start?
Well, I was, like many people, born into a musical family, and both my parents are musicians. So I was always, I mean, from the youngest age, I was always into music, and I was, you know, some of my earliest memories are like going to, because they're both orchestral musicians, my parents. My mum still plays in the Royal Opera House Orchestra. She's a violinist. My dad was a cellist at ENO for a very long time, English National Opera. All my kind of earliest memories are like being dragged around rehearsals and things like that. And sort of, I've got all these memories of being a sort of toddler getting in people's way at Abbey Road and all this kind of stuff. So I guess it was always just music all around me all the time. And I've always been, I don't remember a time when I wasn't playing some sort of instrument. So yeah, I didn't really pick up the saxophone until I was a little bit later. I started on the clarinet, like quite a lot of sax players. But yeah, I think I was always into music. I was always like writing music and things like that, even when I was quite young. It wasn't until a bit later that I really got into the saxophone, when I was about maybe like sort of 17, 18. That was when I was like, actually, yeah, saxophone is the one. But I think I was always like making music with my friends and playing in bands and, you know, just kind of messing about the way that a lot of people do when they're younger and not with any particular agenda in mind, you know. But yeah, it was always music. And then I had a teacher at school called Brian Booth, who actually quite a few jazz musicians might know, because he's one of these people who's kind of quietly been kind of quite influential in a lot of people's lives. Like, I think he used to run a big band in Islington before I knew him, and people, which I think, if I've got this right, people like Martin Speak and Andy Panay and a lot of other people, Ralph Salmons, all these people who are kind of, you know, names that people might have heard of, all kind of came through his bands over the years. He's quite old now, but he used to teach at my school, and he had a little jazz band, which I used to play in. So did Andy Chapman, if anyone knows Andy Chapman. He used to be a drummer who was around a lot. He doesn't seem to be playing in London a lot anymore, but there's quite a few. Anyway, basically, he's one of these people, I think, with jazz, you get these little pockets of musicians who all kind of come out. You know, just, you just get one teacher who's really into the music and kind of makes opportunities for people to play. And then suddenly you get like a whole bunch of musicians who appear. Like, there's like a disproportionate number of musicians from Derby and from Norwich and from Surrey. And then my one was in Watford. I'm from Watford, and this was at Watford Boys Grammar School, and he used to run this jazz group. And I think I just got, yeah, I just kind of, as soon as I was like set free to just like, he was like, right, you know, play the tune. And then you just make it up and off you go. And then I was just like, yeah, this is the one. I can do this, you know. And that was kind of just got the bug from that, really.
So at what age did you first try playing a sax?
Well, like I said, I started on the clarinet. So I got a clarinet. I started on the clarinet when I was probably about, guessing about nine, maybe something like that, eight or nine, ish. You know, this sort of typical age that people tend to start learning a proper instrument. I was like learning the recorder and things like that before that. But yeah, I got a saxophone when I was about 12, I think, maybe 12 or 13. Right. At which point, I pretty much never touched my clarinet again until I was about 25. So yeah,
I know that feeling.
Yeah. It's so much easier, isn't it? You know, you get a saxophone, you don't have to bother with all of that nasty kind of learning how to cross the break and all that kind of nonsense that you have to do on the clarinet. It's amazing. Yeah. It's like someone's just taken away all the obstacles and you can just play. It's the easiest instrument in the world. It's brilliant. So, yeah, I just kind of never looked back from that point on.
Amazing. Do you still find the clarinets much easier now as a result of all of your years of practice as a kid?
It probably is, but I think when I first picked up when I picked up a clarinet, when I got to music college, you have to do a bit of, well, I went to Guildhall and we had to do a little bit of doubling on clarinet and flute. The flute I never got on with at all, but the clarinet, when I first picked it up then, it did feel really clunky and awkward, but since then I've got used to it again and I can sort of get around it now. I think that's mostly just to do, because I do quite a lot of teaching. I've got a lot of clarinet students, so I've sort of, when you teach it, you have to kind of pick it up most days just to play it. Just from doing that, it's kind of come back again. But I know some people find it hard. I mean, I listened to, or I read something about Stan Saltzman once, and he was just talking about how much he hated playing the clarinet and couldn't get to grips with it at all. And he's an amazing flute player, but yeah, I'm totally the other way around. I can't do the flute at all. I just can barely get a sound out of it. Whereas the clarinet sort of just feels like a slightly more awkward saxophone to me, so it's not too bad. But I'd love to be a better clarinetist, though. I mean, I'd love to be able to, like, you know, just really play it properly instead of just kind of getting by on it, which is what I do now.
Yeah, I have phases where sometimes I think I'm really good at it, you know, and then other times, like yesterday, I was trying to sight read some grade 5 pieces. Yeah. I don't know, I haven't practiced for a couple of days, and I just couldn't do it at all. I was like, what's the matter with me? How's this happening? No,
I get that all the time. And it's just those little things that you take for granted on the saxophone. You just kind of get used to being able to sight read everything and play in every key and all that kind of stuff. And then suddenly you try and play the clarinet, and it's like you have to really think through everything because it's such a This is really boring to anyone who doesn't play the clarinet. But
Put a warning.
Yeah. Basically, part of the story is the clarinet's really hard. If you write music, please don't write really hard things for saxophone players to play on the clarinet, because it gives me up in cold sweats thinking about it. So
you play in Miguel Garrido's band.
Yeah, Miguel's band, yeah.
And he does this to you, doesn't he?
He really does do this to me, yeah. He is the person who gives me the cold sweats the most. Like, his clarinet, and he seems to have a knack of, like, the things that he writes for clarinet seem to, they're almost like if you were writing a study for a clarinet player to, like, roast them on the hardest bits of the clarinet. He seems to, like, without any awareness of what he's doing, he seems to manage to do that every time. So yeah, I've, like, spent a lot of time sweating over his music. There's a few bits on his record where I'm pretty sure that they've kind of, like, really subtly just faded me down a little bit because I'm just not nailing it at all. But I think it's, like, I'm gonna say it's unplayable. It's unplayable by me anyway. It'd be amazing if it was playable, but yeah.
I hear you say that, because when I played on Reuben Fowler's first album on the bass clarinet, and I always thought that was suspiciously quiet in the mix as well.
Yeah. There might be a bit of a conspiracy going on.
I think so, yeah. So when did you decide, like, did you have a... Obviously, you've got this teacher at school. I totally agree with your point that you get a disproportionate number of jazz musicians. Oh, that was one other thing I was going to say to you. If you're not bored and you are still listening and you're wondering what we're going on about, I don't know about for you, Mike, but like George Crowley's clarinet playing has always sort of fascinated me by just how good it is.
Yeah.
You know, when he's improvising as well, you know, and he can really, like, play around on it. It's very interesting. Yeah.
I think George did the sort of proper straighty clarinet thing when he was learning. You know, I think he took it I said, I kind of played the clarinet up until I got a saxophone and then immediately just dropped it. But I think George actually like kept it on and did grade eight and all that stuff. So he's actually got the chops, you know, he's actually worked on it. I think he even owns an A clarinet. You'd imagine that.
Wow, an A.
Yeah. So yeah, he's the real deal. He can actually play the thing.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Not very many of those people around.
When did you decide that jazz was the thing that you were going to do?
Well, I guess, like I said, I kind of got hooked on it when I was playing in that band. And before that, I always knew it was going to be something musical, but I think I wasn't exactly sure what that was going to be. And I always really liked sort of making my own music. I wasn't very interested in like just learning kind of long, complicated classical pieces that were written by someone else. I wanted to be, you know, I wanted it to be my own music, and I wanted to have the creative freedom to do what I wanted to do. And I was sort of playing in a lot of like, you know, I was playing in like rock bands and I used to hack away on the guitar. I've got no guitar skills at all, but I used to, you know, had enough chords to be able to kind of do that kind of thing. And I was just, you know, the main thing I was interested in was just like making music and being sort of spontaneous to just, you know, just playing with my friends and things like that. So I think when I started to get a bit more serious about it, as I kind of came towards the end of school and had to think about what I was going to do, I think jazz just appealed to me as something where you kind of had to actually really get good at your instrument, and you could go to music college and study properly, but you still kind of retain that freedom to be yourself. And kind of, it seemed like it had the best of everything, really. You know, I think that's one of the things that's really unique about jazz, is it's this kind of hybrid of kind of all those kind of things about music. You know, if you're kind of, I mean, there's lots of really creative classical players, obviously, but I think you tend to get segregated into composers and performers at quite an early age. There's not very many people who do both, or at least not sort of, they, you know, there are players who do a bit of composing and there are composers who do some playing, but it's more unusual, I would say. But in jazz, it's like, yeah, everyone plays their own music. You know, it's brilliant. Everybody's like expected to be. And I guess if you're an improviser, you're also, you know, it's kind of spontaneous composition as well. So, you know, and it's all about finding your own voice and kind of doing things your own way and having freedom to be yourself. And I think, yeah, so as I kind of got a bit more serious as I got older, that just seemed to be the right place for me. It just felt very natural. And I quite like the other things about, you know, I was, like I said, I'd like kind of, when I was a teenager, I wanted to be in like rock bands and stuff, but then I wasn't cool enough to be in a rock band, you know. And I really like the fact that with jazz, it was just, you'd go to a like bar somewhere and it would just be a bunch of really unassuming kind of people wearing t-shirts and jeans, just kind of playing this amazing music, but without really any of the kind of, you know, veneer of cool, or without, you know, having to worry too much about stagecraft and all that kind of stuff and image making. It just seemed to be kind of a lot of the bullshit had been stripped away, really. And I kind of, that was very appealing to me at a young age as well. So yeah, it just felt like a natural fit at that point. But I don't know, really. You know, who knows why you get into anything? You just have to make a choice, don't you? And you go,
I love that. Who knows why anyone does anything?
Yeah, that's what I think I did. But you know, who knows? I might be putting that might all just be, you know, you go back and you tell these stories in retrospect, don't you? But yeah, it felt like the right place to be at the time.
And then you studied at the Royal Academy on the undergrad.
To Guildhall, actually.
What?
Yeah.
What? I
didn't get into the Royal Academy.
Oh my God, whole life I never knew this.
Yeah, I was at Guildhall, yeah.
Wow, this is a mind-blowing revelation.
Yeah. Wow. I applied for Academy, I didn't get in. I took a gap year before I applied, and when I applied, I did the audition, and Gerard Presenza, who was the head of jazz at the time, said, he was like, oh, well, you know, maybe you could take a gap year and go away and practice and come back next year and then you'd probably get in. And I was like, well, already taken a gap year. So I went to Guildhall, and also I mentioned Andy Chapman, who was at my school. He was a drummer who was in that same jazz band as me, and he'd gone on to Guildhall as well. So I kind of had a bit of a connection there. And yeah, so I ended up at Guildhall under Martin Hathaway and all the people who were guilt all the time.
Wow, cool.
Yeah.
Who are you playing with then when you're at Guildhall?
Well, there was some really good people. I mean, there's a few people in my year who are still around, but quite a lot of those people are not playing a lot of jazz anymore. But there's a few. I was in the same year as Feeney Bierman, And Anthony Strong was in my year, if anyone knows him. Who else was there? Well, there was people in the kind of years just around my year. There was like Tom Farmer. A couple of years ahead was Tom Challenger, Matt Calvert, loads of other people, actually. And then underneath were people like Miguel, who obviously I'm playing with now in his band, Miguel Garodi. I can't remember now. There's tons and tons of people. Sam Brasher was there a couple of years ago. Rick Simpson, of course. We mentioned Rick. He was here below me at Guildhall. Yeah, and I also played with quite a lot of people from the academy as well, which is maybe why you thought I went there, because I was kind of like, especially towards the end of Guildhall, I think that's when I met people like George Crowley and Callum Gourlay, James Madron. Those kind of people were all at Kit Downs. They were all kind of at the academy at the same time that I was at Guildhall. And right. It was, you know, we used to play together, certainly towards the end of college, and then going out after college, those were the kind of people that I was playing with more than the kind of people who I met at Guildhall, I think.
I think the first time I ever heard your playing was my friend Jack Davies played me the Round Trip CD, you know, because Jack is a trumpeter and was really into Richard's playing. Man, you know, having made that film the last few years, it's been really fun to, like, you know, listen to that soundtrack so many times. Sorry, that album. But your playing on it is just, it's just so ridiculous. I love the vibe of the album because it's not polished, you know, there's so much like energy and excitement in it. But I, you know, could probably sing you a lot of your solos now. But how did you even start? Like, you have a very, very, like, a very, you know, powerful ability to play. I don't know. You can play so fast, but it doesn't sound like it's not like a bebop vibe. I don't feel like I'm getting sort of beaten over the head too hard. You know, not in the like Michael Brecker sense of the like, like something bad's going to happen here.
That how you feel?
No, I mean, I love Brecker, but you know, like, I tried playing some to a student the other day and they were just like, oh, sorry, Jeremy. But like, how did you, it's a bit of a weird question, really. I don't even know what the question is. Yeah. How did you learn to play how you play? Because you don't really sound like anyone else.
Well, that's, I mean, I don't feel like I don't sound like anyone else, but I think we all just sound like the people we listen to. So I was really into, like, I was sort of, I guess when I was at that time in particular, when you're talking about the Round Trip kind of period, this was like, that was almost 10 years ago that we made that album. Now, I think we did it in just at the end of 2009, if I've got that right. So it'll be coming up to 10 years since we recorded it.
Wow.
I might have got that wrong, but I think that's right. It might have been 2010.
Can't think now. I think the copyright on the inside maybe says 2010.
I think that might be when it came out, but I think we might have.
Okay, cool.
Anyway, well, it's that kind of period. So around then, that I was just really into the like kind of Tristano type of players. So I was listening to lots of Warren Marsh and Lee Konitz, and I was listening to loads of Mark Turner. Because I was never really interested in that kind of Brecker kind of. I mean, I like playing fast, as you said, but like more. Not just, I don't know, I never really wanted to sort of get that type of thing down. I was more interested in those kind of long lines and kind of quite, I think it's quite lyrical, that kind of playing, even though it is quite sort of cerebral. Those kind of really, you know, really long linear kind of improvisations. And yeah, it's like it's fast and virtuosic, but in a sort of melodic kind of way. And in, you know, they don't like play particularly loud necessarily and things like that. So that's what I was into at the time. I was just listening to, I mean, at that kind of when I came out of college and my last year of college and around that time, I was just pretty much listening to Mark Turner and Warren Marsh all day for about 2 years. And I just didn't really listen to anything else. So like, yeah, and that's what I was listening to. So I guess it's just that. I mean, when I listen to my own playing, I hear that in there and I just hear the things that I've listened to. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe that's, I think that's all you can say about that, really. And since then, I think I was really heavily into that at that time. And I was probably, you know, when I think back to how I was playing then, it was maybe a little bit too sort of stiff in that kind of way, and trying to, you know, I was a little bit sort of in my own head, and now I try and play in a bit more of a loose kind of way. And since then I've had big phases of being into people like Joe Lovano, who I think is like amazing, and sort of playing, you know, great sort of lines and things like that. But in a, you know, he doesn't sound like anyone. He doesn't sound, he's completely inside the jazz tradition, but the content of his lines is just completely personal. He doesn't sound like Tristano players, or he doesn't sound like Charlie Parker, or he doesn't sound like Brecker. He just sounds like himself, and he's got that incredible ability to sort of stretch the time around and kind of, you know, just, he just sounds really free. And I kind of, you know, I love all those sort of records. I've just been listening to a load of like Paul Motion, him on there and things like that recently, and thinking back to that, I used to listen to loads and loads of that. So yeah, I guess my playing's just come from listening to loads of those kinds of things, really.
Yeah,
I do bebop though. I mean, I wouldn't have thought, I don't know, you know, who knows, I don't hear my, no one hears their own playing the way that anyone else hears it, but you know, I think there's loads of bebop in my playing, and I've you know, learned loads and loads of Charlie Parker solos and things like that over the years.
Yeah, you
know, absolutely love playing that stuff, especially on alto sax, you know.
Yeah, what made you go with the alto as your, you know, was it just,
I just owned an alto. That was literally the only reason. That's just the only saxophone I owned for a very long time. I didn't get a tenor until much, till quite recently, actually, till maybe like 4 or 5 years ago. So before that, I had an alto. I had a soprano as well, but you don't really get booked for gigs on soprano, so you've got to go with alto or tenor. So yeah, that was literally it. But to be honest, I don't, I've never, apart from Charlie Parker and Lee Konitz to an extent, but like most of the sax players I've listened to over the years have been tenor players. So like, I've not really got any particular love for the alto. It just happens to be what I've grown up playing and what I feel most comfortable on, because I've just spent the most time playing it. But I've always wanted to sound like tenor players. I've always wanted to sound like Warren Marsh and Mark Turner and Joe Lovano, basically. So just been trying to do that on alto.
Yeah.
The compromises that come with that.
Have you ever been tempted to give it a whirl on the tenor?
Well, I've got a tenor, so I've played it, you know, I do sometimes play it, but it just doesn't feel very comfortable to me because I just haven't put the hours into it. And it's such a, like, there's so much tradition on the tenor. It's like this huge weight kind of, you know, just all these incredible tenor players. And then even just locally in London, there's just so many absolutely burning tenor players.
Oh, I totally agree. I couldn't, you know, like, I try and avoid mine now. When I put my album out, I was like, oh, which incidentally, sorry to do this in the middle of your interview, is just become available to buy.
I listened to your trailer the other day. It sounded great.
Oh, thanks. Thank you. That's very kind.
Yeah.
Like you say, I kind of wanted to avoid the, like, I used to play in my own band on the tenor, and then I don't know, one time I was like, oh, I'll take my sop, it's not so heavy, you know, and playing on the soprano, I just felt like free.
It's just great. I love playing soprano, and I feel exactly the same. It's like, you just, like, you don't sound like anyone, because it's like there just aren't that many soprano players to sound like, and most of the time when you hear soprano, it's like a tenor player or an alto player doubling, and they don't have like that strong voice that they do on their own instrument. So it's like, yeah, you just, I had a big period of playing just, I kind of almost, I flirted with just giving up the alto at one point and just becoming a soprano.
Wow.
Like, it was about a couple of years where I just kind of put my alto down and played soprano, and I was listening to Steve Lacy and, you know, just kind of thinking, yeah, this is the one. You know?
Yeah.
And it's such a, like, I think soprano is like this incredibly sort of, it's an incredibly expressive instrument as well, compared to like alto and tenor. It feels like the amount of kind of different sounds you can make out of that, and the way you can shape the sound, it's like really freeing, you know. I love that instrument. It's just that no one wants it. Like, I was like, yeah, I'm going to play just soprano. And then people would ring me up for a gig and I'd be like, is it all right if I bring my soprano? And they were like, can you bring your alto? So yeah, it kind of didn't really work.
I have that exact problem when I got out of the car once for a gig, and my tenor was still in the boot. I walked into the venue with just my sop, and the bass player looked up at me and was like, oh God, please tell me you bought your tenor as well. I was like, what's the problem? He wasn't happy.
I know, it's hard. Yeah.
I'm trying to do that exact thing you say at the moment, like almost like a personal rebrand. Of like having done my album only on soprano, and I much prefer that, and I completely agree, it's so expressive, and you know, but I could probably count on one finger the amount of bands I've played in where someone said to me, hey, man, you know, just the sot, please. You know, yeah. I mean, for me, it's always like Barry Sachs bass clarinet, you know.
Yeah.
The people have spoken, but yeah. It's funny that doesn't come up more, you know. No.
Do you know, have you heard of Sam Newsom?
Yes, I had a lesson with him, actually.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I went to New York and took my soprano and sent some emails. I didn't really know who he was. I did a bit of research and he seems really nice. I went to Long Island University on a little day trip with him. But he's never, ever come up in conversation in my life until this moment.
Well, because I follow him on Twitter and read his blog and stuff sometimes, and he's talked quite a lot because he's someone who was a tenor player and then like made a conscious decision that he's going to put the tenor down and just focus on soprano, even if it meant losing all his work. Because he said, well, I don't care. This is my voice now and I don't want to do anything else. So, you know, and then he's made a niche for himself doing that, you know.
Yeah. That's what made me want to go see him, because I only had my soppers. This was in 2009, you know, like I knew I'd get it on the plane without it going in the hold and being crushed.
Right.
So, yeah, like trying to find someone else to be like, how is this a thing? You know, what can this be the way? He's done it, you know, with far more commitment. I do it up until someone like wants me to play a function, you know, and then I'm always like, oh, you know.
Well. Yeah, I don't know if he does that. I don't actually think he does that much playing, like he does his own playing, but I don't think he's in any bands or anything. I think he just does his own thing and teaches. But like his own, I mean, he's doing some really, you know, interesting things with that instrument, just kind of exploring the extended techniques and stuff, which is cool.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
That was, anyway. I went for a lesson with John Escrete the next day as well. It's my like pre academy jazz pilgrimage, you know.
Right. I was like, when was
this? I was in my third year at the RNCM, which is, you know, like quite a classical course.
Okay.
And I wanted to
grad at the academy or something, or what's,
yeah, I did the postgrad after. So like,
okay.
There was a week at the Northern where Chris Potter came to play. And it's funny you saying about the soprano. He always strikes me as someone a bit like that. Like on the tenor, he's so iconic. But when he plays sop, it loses a bit of the individual voice, as you say. Yeah. Nothing personal, of course, just a mild observation.
Yeah, it's inevitable, isn't it? If you've spent those people have spent countless tens of thousands of hours on tenor and then they pick up the soprano once in a while and play it. So, of course, they don't have the same sort of relationship with that instrument. It's inevitable.
Yeah, it was a life lesson for me when I was younger, again, like in my Brecker obsession, finding a track where he played soprano and thinking, wow, I can't wait to hear this, and then of course being like, oh, it's actually not really a thing, you know, could be anyone.
Have you heard Potter on alto though? That's a thing.
Yeah, I have actually, that Gratitude album.
Oh yeah, and there's a bit of there's a few videos of him and Dave Holland's band on alto as well.
It's about that.
Absolutely frightening. Right. There you go.
He is quite a frightening guy.
He is, sure, on a personal level as well.
I remember he came to the RNCM jam session after one of those gigs when he was there, and he played Stella by Starlight on the piano. Yeah, and I remember Tom Taylor next to me, who'd had quite a few beers. It was very funny. He just like really loudly went, oh no, Chris is better than me at the piano. I was like, well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry to say, you know, it's great though. You know, anyway, so.
A human person anyway, you can't worry about people like that. They're just a different species.
Yeah, that is a weird one. I don't know, I don't know how he's gotten into that situation. What were we talking about? It was about Chris and about the soprano and about, oh, that was right, it would somehow got onto my life story instead of yours. Of going on this jazz. So Chris came to the Northern and basically like completely destroyed my hopes of a contemporary classical career, which I quite fancied. I quite enjoyed it. And then a week with him and I was like, what am I doing, you know? I've got to like sell. I sold my saxes and bought even older, even more expensive ones, you know. And went to New York and took the sop, had some lessons, you know. And then it's like this is the way forward. And then of course that all led on to making a podcast, which was the real aim.
Yeah, well, it's great. It's amazing. I'm so glad you're making this podcast. Like, yeah. Such a good thing. Just before you started doing this podcast, I was having a conversation with someone like the week before, and I said, wouldn't it be great if someone did a jazz podcast and they interviewed all the jazz musicians, and it would be a really good way of people getting to know about the jazz scene. And then like about 2 days later, I looked online and you were like, we're launching the jazz podcast. It was amazing timing. It was like you read my mind.
It was like, for me, I was just thought, I don't get to see everyone that much anymore. Like, it's hard to go and hang out and, you know, you can't, I don't know. I thought it'd be like a great way of having like a virtual digital hang.
Yeah.
You know, and of course the listeners can chat along and interrupt and pause it and add their own thoughts whenever they want.
I think it's great. And I think actually jazz musicians are like not necessarily very good at like communicating what they're doing and sort of reaching out beyond their little clique of people who already know about them, you know, other musicians. So
yeah,
it's quite useful to have a place where people can actually just, you know, talk and not hide behind their instruments.
No. Yeah, totally. My big problem here is I realized I preferred the talking to the playing.
Right.
You know, there's bits on the gig in between tunes, I'd be like, maybe I should abandon the saxophone completely here and just start talking.
Yeah, it could be one of the like one of those 1950s radio announcers that you get at the beginning of those like live recordings of Charlie Parker.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I could do that. I could just go around London introducing people's gigs for them.
Yeah.
That could absolutely be my new thing.
Definitely, yeah.
Could tell people I've got loads of gigs and then leave it at that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
So what's in the diary? What's coming up?
I've got a new band, so that's quite exciting.
You guys are playing at the Vortex soon, right?
Yeah, we're playing by the time this goes, I don't know when this is going to go out, so it might be too late, but we're playing at the Vortex on the 18th of July.
Oh.
But we're hoping to get a few more. We're playing at the Empire Bar tomorrow, so I'm guessing this isn't going to go out before tomorrow. But then we're playing at the Vortex 18th of July. We've got one at the Consella Bar in December.
Oh, nice.
But this is our like little preliminary run of gigs while we get to know, because I've written some really hard music, obviously, and like we need to get to play it a bit so that we know what we're doing, and then hopefully we're going to do a bit of recording and all that kind of stuff and try to book some more gigs for next year. So yeah, you'll keep an eye on it and there'll definitely be other chances to come and see it, and kind of thinking about, you know, what we should do next with it.
Who is in your band?
So it's Ivo Neem on piano and Connor Chaplin on bass, and Tom Farmer's going to do a few of the gigs because Connor is much too good for us and can't ever get him to you know, do any of the gigs.
Right.
John Scott on drums as well.
Oh, wonderful.
So yeah, it's gonna be good. We did our first gig a couple of weeks ago at Morley College, and it was really good actually.
Yeah, that's like a new series that Flavio Lavini's running.
That's right, yeah.
I think he's worth checking out.
Well, the series as it was has just finished because we did the last one, but he's definitely planning to do some more. And it's a really nice kind of space to play in, and the sound's good. And we did a little chat before the gig, which talked a little bit about Mark Turner, and they're going to make that into a little podcast thing as well and stuff like that. So yeah, it's good. I mean, I think they're definitely going to do some more of those. It's really nice. Yeah,
that sounds awesome. That's a really cool place to have jumped in on the like first season of.
Yeah, I used to teach there, so I kind of had a little bit of
nice, cool.
Yeah, it's a good place.
So, and Flavio's doing a lot of great work there from what I can gather.
Yeah.
To, you know, set these gigs up and give people another place to play.
Yeah, definitely what we need.
So what do you do when you're not practicing the saxophone? How do you like switch your brain off?
Switch my brain off.
If it goes off, that is.
Yeah, the challenge, isn't it? I don't know. I'm quite quiet. I like to stay at home, hang out with my girlfriend. She's got a little bakery business, and sometimes we go and sell her baked stuff at farmers markets and things like that. So if you ever wander around St Albans on a Sunday, you might spot me flogging some brownies behind a store.
Cool.
Do that a little bit, and yeah, I don't know, really. Just, I don't have any very exciting hobbies. I just like, you know, watch TV, things like that. Watched Chernobyl the other day.
That's really good.
Oh, it's amazing, yeah. It's the best thing I've ever seen. You should watch it. It's great.
What is it on?
It's on, it's an HBO thing, so it's on like whatever the thing where that is, Now TV.
Good work. Okay. Yeah. You're the second person that has told me how great that is.
Oh, it's really good. Yeah. And the music's kind of really interesting as well. It's like kind of weird electronic music with all these little Geiger counter noises and things going on. It's very cool. Apparently they recorded the soundtrack in an old nuclear reactor or something. It's all very clever.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah. It's great. Yeah.
Anything? Is there any other TV shows, any books, anything that you're really fired up by? You know, I could talk about House all day. I do love Hugh Laurie.
I don't know. I'm not, there's nothing in particular. Sometimes I go and watch Watford Football Club. That's my great thing to do. Outlet. Yeah, when I'm not teaching on a Saturday, I'll go down and watch Watford. Watch them get pummeled 6-0 in the FA Cup final the other day. That was
that was a tough one.
But that's a good thing to do. Yeah, I don't know. I try and when I'm doing musical things, I'm really full on about music, and then I'll kind of try not to do anything musical, so I don't kind of. Yeah, I don't just sit at home thinking about music all day. I try and compartmentalize my life a little bit, because I think it can go a bit crazy if you're just doing music all day, all the time, which is what I used to do.
Yeah, so if you like teach all day and then come in and practice, like have a rehearsal or a gig or something, you know?
Definitely. Or like when I was like, you know, younger, when I was at college, I used to every conversation I had about was about music. Everything I did was listening to music. I'd go to a gig, come home, listen to some music, get up, play some music, you know, talk, have a conversation about music. And you just, I don't think you actually make very good music when you're doing that.
Well, Mike Chillingworth, or Killingworth, as I always prefer. Thank you for coming on the Jazz Podcast. It's been an absolute joy to try and pick your brains. I'm going to finish. Probably should have asked you before about some tracks. There'll be some thing. We'll talk about it and we'll find some tracks. I'd quite like to play a bit of Round Trip. And maybe something super new, you know, that you're into. Dan and I can discuss at great length. But thank you for coming on the show. It's been awesome.
No problem. Anytime. Thanks, man.
Thank you. Well, Dan, that track was from Mike's album from a couple of years ago, Scratch and Sift, which is on Two Rivers Records. That was called... what was that called? Uh-oh. I think I might have... did I ever even say what the name of that first track was?
Yeah, you did.
What did I call it?
Oh, can't remember, Rob.
Oh, my God.
Well, Morley College.
Clip from Morley College, that's the one.
Yeah.
Hang on, I took some photos to avoid this. Aha, yes, that's right. That tune. Right, let's start again. Let's pretend none of that happened.
Okay. But you're not going to edit that out, are you?
It's much funnier if people can see the crippling ineptitude behind the show. Okay, that was Scratch and Sift. That's the album name. That was Mike Chillingworth's Butterman from the album Scratch and Sift, which was out in 2016 with Tom Challenger, Josh Arcaleo, George Crowley, Lewis Wright, Sam Lasserson, and John Scott. There are copies of that album available on Mike's website, his Bandcamp. I think that went pretty well.
I think you nailed it, Rob.
That was one hell of a segue.
You killed it.
Yeah.
Have you seen Stranger Things? Three.
No.
Oh, that's what I've been watching. You haven't seen any of it?
No, never.
Rob.
What's it on?
Netflix.
Oh, that's a
great show. You don't have Netflix.
I've been watching Downton Abbey.
Okay, you are quite behind.
Yeah, tell me about it. I'm only on season four. I was at the cinema with our old friend, Classic Jake, and my wife, Claire, and a trailer came on for the Downton Abbey movie, and we basically had to, like, close our eyes, close our ears, and scream at the top of our voice in order to not find out anything.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Stranger Things, eh? I need to...
Oh, yeah, I recommend.
Okay, great. We've got a long list at the
good
moment.
Good show.
You know, the list's so long at the moment, it's actually stressful.
Well, add Stranger Things. Move it up to the top.
Okay.
You won't regret it.
All right. I like that. I need some serious direction right now.
Yeah.
In many ways. So next show is going to be in 2 weeks with Jesse Appia, who's a producer and a singer. Session vocalist.
Great.
He's really a big deal. Much bigger than me, but
that's not hard though, is it?
It's not hard at all. So that will be fun. I'm going to Malaysia next Saturday.
Oh, so, man. Yeah, you are, for like a while.
Yeah, 6 weeks, five
cool.
weeks. So,
what are you going to do?
I'm just going to sit around and
just. Claire's working, isn't she?
Yes, she is. So I feel actually quite bad about how much relaxing I'm going to do. I'd like to be her, like, secretary a little bit.
Yeah.
Fill out some forms, maybe. Do some swimming. I'm going to get in the shape of my life. I'm going to come back and you're going to be stunned.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
Can't wait to see it.
Yeah. I'm going to blend in, let me tell you right now.
Yeah.
All right, so I'll speak to you. I might be in Malaysia. We can do some international...
Yeah, you have to work out the time zone, though.
Yeah, exactly. There's going to be a very, very narrow window, knowing us.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, this is all key information for the listener. So, obviously, you know, brace yourselves for that. And we should probably get out of here, and I'll see you next week.
Bye, mate.
All right. That's probably an ending, isn't it?
I think so, if ever there was one.
That's literally the end of the show.
Forever.
Oh, I see. No, just for
now. Ugh.
So, good try. I like your style.
I thought that was it.